to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am Justin Landon, and tonight I am joined by the exquisite Robert Jackson Bennett. Robert is the author of four novels, including Mr. Shivers and American Elsewhere, both of which won him the Shirley Jackson Award, The Company Man, which won him an Edgar Award, and The Troop, which won him nothing, despite being his finest novel. His fifth novel, A City of Stairs, comes out September 9th, and his Twitter feed is performance art. What's going on, Robert?
So exquisite makes me sound like a pastry or something like that, like, you know, just immaculately made. I like it. I like that.
Yeah, and anybody that's had the opportunity to see your video that you made, A Sexual Experience, is not going to debate the use of the word exquisite.
I don't think that you possibly could. I think that you could be prosecuted in a court of law for claiming that I'm anything short of exquisite. I think that I can make that work.
We'll do it. We'll put that down as a requirement that in the future. Yeah, you should really write it into your future book contracts that
I feel like it should they should call me exquisite, then like bang cymbals and like slowly back out of the room just whenever they say my name. I feel like that's not too much to ask. You know, I got a lot of cymbals. I can ship them ahead. This could very easily be arranged. I don't see a downside to this.
It would be a challenge to communicate that on a dust jacket of a book, but I'm sure there's a way. I mean, books are getting more interactive all the time.
Yeah, that's not my problem.
So I often call you RJB when referring to you, but not like in person or even now that I'm actually talking to you. But whenever I talk about you in text or really anytime anybody else talks about you in text, they refer to you as RJB. Is that an internet creation or have people referred to you that way all your life?
No, that's an internet creation. I was actually, you know, when I first was about to get published, they were just going to be like Robert Bennett. And I was like, you know, that's a really common name. And they were like, well, how common is it? And then I was like, let's look on Google. And yeah, a senator from Utah was Robert Bennett, Bob Bennett, very famous conservative guy, got booted out with the first wave of the Tea Party peeps. And it was kind of weird. I was like, you know, there's also a lot more Robert Bennett besides that. And then I got a gift certificate for a massage. And this was like the like last day that I had to like make my choice about what I wanted my name to be. And I went in to go and get the massage. And she was like, oh, Robert Bennett, that's my husband's name. And I was like, yeah, I'm not doing this shit. There's just too many of us. I have to throw in the middle name. So previous to my writing career, no one ever used my middle name at all unless I was in trouble. So this is a wholly new experience to me. It's still really awkward to walk up to somebody and be like, hello, I'm Robert Jackson Bennett. Cause it feels like I should throw in like the third or some kind of crap at the end. You know, it's very formal. It makes me sound very important or like I've shot a president. That's the other thing that it makes me sound like.
It does a little bit. Did you ever consider the R Jackson Bennett, you know, just drop in the first name?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to kind of maybe do the J.K. Rowling thing, stay a mystery. But I forget how, but at some point in time we just chose to go with Robert Jackson Bennett. It sounds like a very impressive name. I'm not really convinced that I live up to it. I mean, Robert Jackson Bennett I would take seriously. Robbie Bennett probably sells cars. Bobby Bennett, a boxer. You know, there's all these types of people that my name could be, and I'm none of them.
Yeah, and Jackson Bennett's that's clearly like an athlete name. That's like a center fielder or a point guard.
Yeah, I was thinking like a safety.
I always thought that if I were to write, I would be Justin Hamilton Landon or Jay Hamilton Landon, but it's so goddamn long. And that's that Robert Jackson Bennett. I mean, you're going to have a real challenge ever becoming the name bigger than the title just because your name's so long. I mean, if it was bigger than the title, it would take up half the front cover.
So your middle name's Hamilton?
Yeah.
That's pretty hardcore.
that's a middle name, all right.
Like I hear Hamilton, I think Alexander, and I think pigs. And I don't know why I think pigs. I guess it's just the ham thing, that Hamilton is the name of choice for cartoon pigs.
Hamilton the pig. I don't know what that's from, but it's a thing.
Yeah, it's got to be a thing. It's somewhere in our subconscious.
So yeah, I'm all for pretentious names. You're for pretentious names, clearly. And maybe it's, you know, it's helped you in the award scene. I mean, you've won kind of these more literary-leaning awards. Maybe that the pretentious name has aided you.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when they look at the ballot, they might like perceive or like associate it with a bar graph. They see, you know, like there's a long name, a longish name. Oh, wow, that's a really long name and a short name. And they're like, you know, length is good, quantity is good. So maybe that should just, you know, and if that's true, then that would probably explain why my last book won, because holy shit, that thing is, you know, it's bigger than a cinder block. I could build houses out of that very easily. I feel like I'm probably responsible for a lot of hernias around the book selling industry. I think that I probably hurt some families very deeply, and I'm fine with that.
What's interesting about this notion that American Elsewhere, which is the book you're referring to, is so long. But now your new book out September 9th, The City of Stairs, is actually a fantasy, like a more stereotypical fantasy novel, but is not as long as this bizarre genre mashup thing that you wrote last.
Yeah.
That's a little weird. It's a little cognitively dissonant.
Well, the thing about American Elsewhere is that I'm exploring a really big theme. I'm exploring the idea of a small town in America that is somehow, it feels as though it is in spirit with the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And it's, you know, about how what we think of as a town, like when you think of an American small town, you think of like the white picket fences, the Leave It to Beaver shit. And I wanted to look at, why do we think of that? I mean, like, there's a lot of meat on that bone. There is existing meat on that bone. When you're writing a fantasy story, that's second world, you have to put the meat on the bone. And there's like themes and ways that you could do it, but, you have to make all the roads and all the rabbit holes that you want to go down. And, when I came to it, I was like, you know, I wanted to have it feel kind of streamlined. I was like, you know, I could throw a bunch of like crap together and have it look at all these like different little like wandering alleys. I just didn't really feel the need to do that. And that book actually, that book being City of Stairs, came together really nicely and really easily. It's a very streamlined, weirdly functional, little book. I mean, it feels like a very tightly wound machine. And it's not a little book. It's 140, 150,000 words. Whereas AE is like 230,000 words. So it's considerably longer. But I like knew which themes I wanted to look at in City of Stairs. I knew how I wanted to look at them. And I got in and I got out and I got on. It was kind of like how they say, the heist movies, smash and grab job. Whereas in AE, you know, you show up at this town, you want to hang out, you want to look at it from all the different aspects, all the different perspectives of all these, like, I think I have like 30 characters, 40 characters in that book, all of which have a unique take on small town life and the horrors and the beauties of living in this town of Wake.
I think it's interesting that you talk about American Elsewhere being a longer book and having to set up all this stuff that you wanted to chase, where City of Stairs, you didn't necessarily have to do that. I can't help but wonder if part of that is you wrote with City of Stairs a book that is speaking more to perhaps an established audience that's more familiar with the tropes that you're probably trying to play with or examine, or some of the themes that you're trying to examine more so than the themes and tropes you were looking at in American Elsewhere, just because of the fantasy genre is far more established and far more recognized among readership perhaps than whatever the hell American Elsewhere was.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. But I also think it's true that in City of Stairs, a lot of power of that book comes from the unknown. There's all this history. There's all these myths, these gods that are gone that you don't know a whole lot about. That's really like, it's fascinating. I want to know about it, but you don't know what's past that border. The thing about the unknown, which is really a sense of the mysterious, is that the longer that you look at it and the longer that you don't explain what it is, what's back behind the veil, the more it basically becomes a cock tease. And you're just being cruel and rude and stupid to your reader if you don't, you know, if you just keep on stringing along. And I kind of knew pretty quick that, you know, I can't waste a lot of time in this book. Because if we, you know, like, there's a lot of gods that we could look at. There's a lot of, like, myths that we could look at. But you only have their a willingness to not know for so long. You can only deny them full knowledge for so long, and then you've got to go. Whereas in like American Elsewhere, you had that aspect of what's happening in this town, we don't know. But you still felt that it was like, even if you didn't know, you had a sense of what was going on. There are plenty of small town science fiction stories out there that existed, like the Twilight Zone. We all know what that is on subconscious level as a culture. So we're content, I think, to stay in that small town and let it get dragged out. Whereas in something like City of Stairs, you're thinking, listen, asshole, I know you made this all up. I know that you're not getting to the point. I mean, come on here. Let's just, you know, can we cut to the chase? So that was something that was really on my mind too, which is that each scene that toyed around, it was very coy about like, what are the gods? We just don't know. We really had to make each punch count. And that if we had a scene where it looked at what was beyond that veil, but didn't really go there, that I had to be careful that, at some point in time, you're just a tease. And that's shitty.
I like that Robert Jackson Bennett is now publicly declared he's unwilling to be a cock tease. That's excellent.
Well, in writing, I am. One sweaty night, you know, it could change everything.
So we've talked a little bit here about the fact that City of Stairs is couched within a fantasy genre, and American Elsewhere was more of a horror mix up thing, science fictional, fantasy, a little bit of everything. And you wrote a piece the other day, a post on your blog. Uh-oh. Called The Genre Fountain.
Yeah.
And in which you argued that genre overclassification is something that we need to be worried about. You may have even been so bold as to say that it is a problem.
Yeah. I think if it's not a problem now, then it's definitely going to be pretty soon.
That's the interesting point, is that 50 years ago, it seems to me, of course, I wasn't aware of genres 50 years ago, nor was I alive.
Aware much. Yeah.
Right. But it seems like, you know, we had sort of like, we had science fiction and we had fantasy.
Yeah.
And then over time, these things have become increasingly granular to the point now where we say this book is an urban fantasy, and we don't even know what that means anymore. Well, a lot of people will say urban fantasy means a fantasy set in a city. To me, when I say urban fantasy, I think urban fantasy is a first-person narrator with a snarky protagonist with some element of magic and some element of mundaneness, with a primarily mystery or thriller plot structure.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. That's a little bit more specific. So my idea of what an urban fantasy is was informed by my agent. When I first tried to find an agent, with my agent, you know, she had a list of things that she, you know, like, I'd like to hear more about these sorts of books. And one of them was urban fantasy. And the way that she put it was, it had to be a fantasy. It had to be set on Earth. And the big thing was that you don't have to have a map. You don't have to have a map to get around and figure this stuff out, like a fantasy secondary world map. And that's what kind of stuck in my head, which is that you could have an urban fantasy that even take place in like a big city. It could take place in like Sheboygan, but it would still be like urban fantasy because it would be a focus on where the modern and the mundane meet the fantastical. But yours is like, it's like an urban fantasy noir. Yours is like what actually sells in urban fantasy. I feel like that's what your perspective is. It's like, what's the hot shit? What's really flying off them shelves in urban fantasy is like this, is like the noir, snarky, kind of like Law and Order meets, I guess, Neverwhere kind of thing.
Right. The point I'm trying to make with that is that when we think about urban fantasy, and you talk a lot about this in your post, is that the classifications have been developed so that somebody who read something they liked, in this case, let's say Kevin Hearn, you know, they read Kevin Hearn and they like Kevin Hearn, who writes clearly urban fantasy, regardless of what your definition of it is. If they want something like Kevin Hearn, they don't want probably The City in the City.
No.
Which, under your definition, could be urban fantasy. But that's not what they're looking for. What they're looking for is something else like Kevin Hearn, which, when you talk about urban fantasy, then is Jim Butcher or M.L. Brennan or, you know, a host of other typically mass market paperbacks published by Rock. And that's kind of the interesting thing that when we look at this, that these definitions have developed around marketing, not around readers necessarily.
Yeah.
Classifying, I guess.
Well, I'll say, you know, like a lot of readers, I mean, like a lot of writers currently, I'm a very shitty reader. I do not read a lot. I do not read nearly as much as I should. I will yield to your wisdom when it comes to the genre. As a writer, though, as someone who came into the genre trying to find a place, what it felt like to me was this sort of like kind of like the underground myth of when you go to a certain part of town, and if you wear your handkerchief in a certain kind of way, then it means that you are down for some random sex in this manner. People are like looking for these signs that say exactly what this is, what they're going to get out of it, and what they want to do. If you got a blue handkerchief around your arm in this way, then you're into bears. If you got your like yellow handkerchief stuffed in your pocket this way, then it means that you're into water sports. Things like that. This is, of course, I don't know if this is even true. This might just be a complete myth. But that's kind of what it felt like, was that I didn't have any handkerchiefs. I didn't know anything about the handkerchief system of saying, like, you know, here's my overtures, here's my signals, this is what this is the show that you're going to see. And so I was kind of like, you know, why aren't I getting hit on? I mean, like, why is anybody paying any attention to me? Because I hadn't, like, front-loaded, well, not front-loaded, because that really is kind of, you know, a crappy way to put it. But, like, I just didn't have the tropes in the right places at the right time, it felt like, for folks to be like, I know what that is, and I like it. You know, like, when I first came into this stuff, I was saying, you know, I want to be the rebel. I want to be like, you know, I'm going to forge my own path and do my own thing. And informed a little bit by some things I heard at LawnCon, which was that, like, the genre, like the cross-genre thing didn't work quite as well as everybody had hoped. And that, you know, it had been like a 10-year, 15-year project among the publishers, you know, like, let's see if we can make this fly. Because people always say, I like things that are all kinds of things. That's what they say, but the sales somewhat suggested that might not be the case. So I was one of those guys who was like, you know, I'm going to make up my own genre. And I think that that might have been something that could have been like possible in the 80s or 90s. I'm not sure if that's possible now. And by some weirdo grace of God, I'm still around. I'm not sure if it's God who's behind this. It might be something with much more sinister intentions for all of you people. You know, I'm still hanging around. And City of Stairs, I think, it's kind of funny. Because, you know, I get pretty good reviews. People tend to like my stuff. But with, like, the hardcore genre blogs, the thing that I keep on hearing about City of Stairs is, you know, I've heard of this guy before. I had never read him. Kept on getting told that I should read him. And then I finally read this book, and I liked it. And I kind of have to wonder, I'm like, you know, this guy has, like, every single one of my books. What was it about this one that made them want to open the page? Because, you know, clearly they'd heard from other people that they should read me because they say so. So I do kind of wonder if it's just because, you know, I put my handkerchief in the right place and smiled at them in just the right manner that all of a sudden they're willing to give me a look. Isn't that a great metaphor? I don't know if that's the worst or the best metaphor that I've ever come up with. I mean, like, the genre fountain thing, that was okay. But this, you know, that's something else.
I like that you're comparing genre classifications to sexual signals in weird neighborhoods where this goes on.
We're all freaks. I mean, we're all fringe characters in the genre business, I do think. And that's kind of got its own urban fantasy, too. Why isn't there an urban fantasy story about, you know, like, rando sex in Central Park? I'm sure that there is. I mean, why am I even saying that? There's got to be. You know, you're well read in the genre. Why don't you know about, like, you know, like, you should be like, I got five stories off the top of my head that are all about, you know, Central Park meet and greets, so to speak.
I can't say I've come across that yet, but I'm sure that somebody listening to this would be more than happy to write it. Well, so you talk a little bit about how when you first came into the genre, or first came into the business, that this was a problem, except, of course, that you published your first novel when you were, I don't know, 24?
23.
Yeah, 23 when you came in. So you broke in pretty quickly. First novel did very well. Won an award, and Orbit, who you were published with at the time, seemed to have a pretty good idea of what to do with it. And then as you published subsequent novels, it seemed like perhaps they knew less about what to do with it over time.
Yeah.
And it became sort of harder and harder to find a consistent market for somebody who was writing things that were different each time.
Yeah. I think that part of it was that, this was like, 5 years ago? And there was an expectation that the horror genre was going to change significantly. And so I was one of their horror writers. And I don't think that it has. And I don't think that it did change in the way that a lot of other publishers expected. And, I never really considered myself a straight horror writer, but I know straight horror writers, and they were all like, boy, horror doesn't sell, is what I keep hearing. I have no, this is what I'm told. I think that might be part of it, that there is, that this goes beyond me. I think it's a greater kind of attempt and a movement and a counter movement, within publishing to try and figure out what horror is in the wake of like Stephen King and, Peter Straub and all these other people who were like these huge icons in the 80s and 90s and now are basically slowly, slowly riding off into the sunset. And we all have to choose what horror is now. And nobody has any idea. I don't think that anybody has really any firm idea of what horror is. Because nowadays, even like zombies and things like that, and like vampires feel more like they're owned by fantasy and science fiction than they do horror, you know? So I think that it was a larger issue where, my books have horror elements in it. They didn't fit in a whole lot of other places. We wanted to see if horror worked. And then horror as a whole genre kind of like, seemed to trip out of the gate is the impression that I'm getting. I could be wildly wrong.
We're talking about genre classifications, and one of your writing group friends and somebody I know as well, Joe McKinney, who's, zombie aficionado, dude guy, zombies have become their own subgenre, all its own. I mean, the zombie novel has become a thing. Independent yep. of horror or science fiction or anything else. I mean, it's its own standalone silo of fiction, and there may not be a more compulsive book buyer than the zombie book buyer who yep. just reads zombie, 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 zombie.
And that's so strange to me. Like, I can get wanting to read a zombie novel. I can't get, wanting to read a zombie novel every single day or every single, month even. I think that I would get sick of it. And, but that goes for a lot of things. There's a lot of people who are like, I read this type of book and this is what I'm going to read. And, as I think you can see from my own writing, past, it's hard for me to stick with any one thing, There was a really great, analogy that was made by, I think his name was Richard Kianka, who made somethingawful.com. About what's bad about the internet. And he had this big comparison, which was, okay, so let's say that there's a guy in some small town in like Lubbock, Texas, who likes dressing up like a squirrel because it gives him a sexual thrill. So in 1992, he makes a website about this because, it's 92, the web's a wide open space. Let's give it a shot. And so then what happens is he makes this site and suddenly – he's got 5, 10, 50, 100, 1,000 people on his website who all share this exact same taste, this taste that would normally be, crazy. Why would you want to do this? All of a sudden, these guys are online all day talking about how fun it is and all the different ways to do this, to dress like a squirrel for a sexual thrill. And so this goes on for a few years, and then there is a schism. Where suddenly one group says, if we really want to do this the right way, when we're dressed as squirrels, we can't talk like people. We can only make squirrel sounds. And then there's this other group that says, I disagree. I feel like, we are squirrel people. We can't forget that aspect. We should still say certain things. So there's this big fight that brews in between those who want to say human things as squirrels and those who only want to say squirrel sounds. And so they stop and they grab a random dude and they say, hey, me and my friend here are having an argument. Do you think it's better to be dressed as a squirrel for sexual thrills and not say human things, or to be dressed as a squirrel for sexual reasons and to say human things? And that guy's going to say, like, what in the hell are you talking about? Well, I mean, like, what in the hell is this? He's not going to have any idea of this. But to these guys, because they're in this tight-knit community, because there's 1,000 of them talking about this at all hours of every day, to them, this is perfectly normal. This is their community. This is all that they think about. But to the outside world, this is impenetrable. They never think about this stuff. It never occurs to them to think about this stuff. Now, I'm not saying that genre is in any way as strange and perverse as this, but you can see how that mindset slowly starts to develop, where you're like, you know, I really don't like fast zombies. I think it violates the genre. And then, you know, you like bring that up with like regular people, like your lawyer. You're like, hey, by the way, after you're done with my taxes, what do you think about fast zombies? He's going to be like, what the fuck do you mean? I mean, I don't think about fast zombies. And so it's this idea. I mean, like, to us, these things matter so much. And I'm not saying that they don't matter, but it is worth having some perspective to step back and say, you know, at the end of the day, does it really matter if we use first-person point of view, or when we hop around in these types of genres, these sub-genres, or even sub-sub-genres? It's something that can get dangerous. I feel, well, not dangerous isn't like you're going to lose your arm or something like that. It's more like, you know, this could actually start to secretly suck and we wouldn't know it. That's the danger that I'm talking about. There's plenty of other worse dangers out there. Crossing the street, for example. But this is something that's worth thinking about, and that if we forget that we are basically in our own little conference room on the internet talking about the same thing day in and day out, we might find ourselves up shit creek without a paddle pretty soon.
So it seems then that you could be making the argument that the internet, and particularly the echo chamber, as I often call it, of our own community on the internet, and expanding it even to include, you know, book blogs at large and classification sites like Goodreads and Amazon and all these other various sites, that it's these mechanisms are what's creating this, what has made this problem exacerbated. That the ability for this community to connect the way that it is connected online has probably made this genre overclassification move faster or become more relevant.
Yeah, I would say that it's made it easier. I mean, like, this is not new, but we just have this tool now that makes it a lot easier to do it. And, like, this is human nature, because what we're doing here is just finding what's comfortable and forgetting that there are things beyond what's comfortable, I think. That's my idea, is that we're forgetting that there's a whole nother world outside of this, that in some ways we are almost, I guess, like agoraphobics. We know what we like. We want to stay indoors. We want to stay in our houses. And we definitely don't want to go outside and get barked at by a dog. That would just be terrible, to get barked at by a dog. I don't know if I could deal with that.
The genre classification thing is a challenge, something that you faced in your writing career. What I find is interesting is I was looking at the comments to the article that you wrote on this subject. I saw quite a few people chime in with a statement of sort of like, yeah, man, my books don't fit into a genre box either.
Yeah.
And here is what my book's about. And I, which I thought was fun. Yeah. In a laughing sort of, look at me sort of phenomenon. But it prompted me to consider this fact that as we look at the way that the book business is developing, and the fact that this overclassification phenomenon is sort of, we all recognize, is a tool of marketing, at least at some level, whether readers are adopting it or not, they clearly are. But at its basic, it's how do we market books to people, and how do we get people to pick up and buy certain books? And what's interesting is that I think a lot of the people that responded to your post in that way by talking about their own work were all probably self-publishers. And the idea that as agents and as editors and as publishers become more concerned with, does this fit into a box that I can sell, with decreasing shelf space and all these other things, is it possible that that's something that's actually going to push more and more writers into the self-publishing world, where they can say, well, shit, nobody wants this, but it's really good, and I think it'll find a readership if I can get it out there?
Well, the thing that I kept hearing and that I keep hearing is that the thing they first look for is voice and story. It's got to have a great quality story. And I think that what most agents and what most editors know is that writers are shit-ass awful at saying what their stuff is and at trying to sell it. Writers have no idea what the market is. They have no idea what these terms are. Like, there was a time that I tried to sell a book, and I said it was uptown fiction. Uptown, I mean, it sounds like, you know, like maybe drinks a martini every once in a while, probably doesn't have a car. I don't know. But so I think that currently they're aware that they have to find a good book first and then find a title, the quest or a label for it. The question is that label going to work? And there's always these like experiments out there to try and see, is this shit going to fly? I feel like kind of in my case, it eventually didn't. And then I was, you know, I basically stopped and I said, you know, I've always considered myself to be a fantasy writer. Why don't I just write, you know, straight fantasy? So I did with City of Stairs, and people are responding extremely positively to it. More positively to it than I'm kind of used to, as a matter of fact. But but the question now is more, as always, is on the reader's side. Is our readers going to accept this if we say that it's X or Y? And I think that that's going to be the predictive point. I mean, that's not exact. I mean, I'm not saying anything groundbreaking or earth-shattering there. I'm like, if they can sell it, people will buy it. I mean, that doesn't make any – I mean, that's nothing new. But I do think that currently, at least, the agents and the editors are aware that you first have to find a good story, and then – this word is great – position it in the market, on the shelf, as this, that, or the other. And it's that second step that is oh so delicate and oh so difficult.
Robert, when you use the word position,
yeah, it sounds really bad. I didn't even think about it sexually.
It's just a different word coming from you. I mean, if like an agent said that word, or an editor said that word, or I don't know, 99% of other authors said that word, I wouldn't think anything of it. But when you say it, your Twitter feed flashes through my mind, and I just get a little uncomfortable.
You feel like you should have stretched. Should have pushed your hamstrings. I get it. It's okay.
You talk about City of Stairs and how it's being positioned. Dude, you got a hooded guy on the cover.
I got a hooded guy. You want to talk about handkerchiefs in the right places. I mean, like, if that's not a flag saying, like, you like this shit, you're going to love this shit. And, you know, it's kind of funny that people are actually, like, really digging it. They really like, you know, the world that that I've created there. And, you know, it's kind of funny because when I thought of how I was writing this, three books really came to mind. I think it's three. Hold on a sec. Let me see if I can improvise this. One was the main one that I tried to chase was Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, because it invents this fantastic history. And for so much of the book, it just kind of skirts it. And it never really explores what this history is. And then as you go in like deeper and deeper, you start to get these glimpses and you start to understand these huge rules about how this worked. And you realize that things don't work like that anymore. And that's really fascinating. And I, in fact, wanted to do, I mean, like, I loved it so much. This is how shitty of a writer I am. I wanted to use footnotes. And my editor wisely was like, maybe don't ever think about doing that again in your life. And I was like, yeah, it's a good point. But that was a really fascinating idea. And I really wanted to write a fantasy novel, a second world history, because, you know, like, you sit down and you read, like, some new fantasy, like, series, and you don't know what the fuck the history is, what all the myths are. When they say, oh, the orb of Kilcunin, they're like, yes, that orb. And you're like, I don't know what orb, but you'll tell me eventually, right? I wanted to have a secondary world fantasy where all the characters were in the same spot as the reader. Where they were like, honestly, we don't know. I mean, we know that this myth exists. We have no idea what it means. There's this name that we have on a stone tablet. We don't know who the hell that guy is. We don't know where these stairs came from. We don't know any of this stuff because this horrible thing happened and then all these people died of the plague. We have no idea who we are or how we got here. we're still trying. I mean, we have some idea, and but we tend to do very crappy things with that idea, like invent our own history when we probably shouldn't be doing that. And that was a really fun idea. To a certain extent, you know, as I was writing it, I was like, this is a little bit cheap that these guys don't know this stuff. But I think that that really is how it is for most people. In that, you know, like there's always this kind of like floating question about really like, is history, is the history that I've heard or that I've told, is this complete? Because once you get to be about college here in the States, you slowly start to be like, all right, so I've heard a lot about my country's history, but apparently history has been happening like to every other country ever for like a very long time, and I don't know anything about that. And then suddenly you start to realize maybe there's incredible gaps in my knowledge. And I think that it says a lot about who you are as a person when you start to realize that and start to accept that and start to find out ways to deal with that. Obviously, you won't ever know like everything. But these folks are put in a position where they have to acknowledge very early on, I really don't know like anything about my nation's history or how we got to be where we are right now. The second book that inspired it a lot, and in fact ties into the genre stuff a whole lot, is David Mitchell's The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. That's a historical fiction novel set in the present tense that kind of has its own fantasy novel inside of it. But what's really great about that book is that it fucking throws you into the deep end from the start. It's this obscure part of history that I didn't know anything about, like the fact that Japan in the 18th century was a holy land and was completely closed off to the rest of the world, and that the Dutch had this tiny man-made shit-ass island off the coast of Japan with just a little bridge that led to it, and these guys had to live their whole lives on this island to try and trade with Japan. And there's all these names flying at you, you know, the Dutch names and the Japanese names. I kind of liked being thrown in where it was like, all right, I'm not putting you through the tutorial, because like in games, you know, you're always, all right, I'll do the tutorial. I'm going to figure out how this works. Click, 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 click. I liked that it didn't do that. And it was upfront with really how rich it was. We were like, you had to scramble to try and catch all these like beautiful. It was like trying to look at this gigantic tapestry. And he's a guy, there was like a big article about him, I think, recently in the New York Magazine. About how he transcends boundaries. He just transcends genre boundaries. He goes beyond genre boundaries. And I kind of think, you know, like I've always, like when someone says to me, like, who is the best working science fiction writer today? My gut instinct is always say it's probably David Mitchell. But I think that if he got published as science fiction and was pitched to our genre base, he wouldn't be nearly as successful as he is. I think that he is sold to a mainstream literary crowd that has genre leadings, but is not the genre base. And that's why he's successful, is that he has taken these really genre-y, extremely genre tropes, like hopping from body to body, or like clones, the end of the world, these types of things, and popped them into unusual structures and types of storytelling that mainstream and the literary crowd will accept. But our people sometimes don't like that. I mean, like the thing that I've been hearing a lot about City of Stairs is that it starts slow and it's hard to understand at the start. And The Thousand Autumns is the exact same thing, but it was like a really big success in the mainstream crowd. And you know, this is purely anecdotal bullshit, so take it with a complete grain of salt, because I do. If there are certain tropes that the literary and the mainstream folks out there aren't willing to accept that the genre base is, and there's methods of storytelling and structures of stories that are far more experimental that the genre base is not willing to accept, but the literary mainstream, whatever the hell group is willing to stick with it. Anyway, there was the third book in there, but I can't remember what it was that inspired City of Stairs. I mean, I'd probably say anything written by John le Carré was a really big inspiration. with special like attention to The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which is his first book and his best book. I would say that if you like books, you have to read that book. That's a really interesting book because spying, this was in the 60s, and spying was like this cool, sexy thing where you had like a speedboat and you shot people and other boats exploded and you had a lot of sex and drinking. And this placed it, you know, in the Soviet bloc of like, all right, spying is like the least one ever. Spies are not cool dudes. They are frequently sociopathic like assholes who make sometimes good people do things that they don't want to do and put a lot of folks at risk. But also there's this great line about how what he brings to life in his books are the cold, gray, chilly hallways of spying, of tradecraft, which is that these wars aren't won, you know, like in like a sexy bar with a lady in like a backless dress. It's won by a bunch of nerds at a desk reading a whole lot of like reports and papers and sending that information to some person in the field who's usually a bastard and is not somebody that you would want to meet or ever want to know. And I wanted to, you know, like usually in our genre, in the high fantasy epic genre or whatever the hell, you know, you got your heroes. You got your big broad-shouldered dudes who are handsome and do all this cool stuff. And I really wanted to have someone who fights wars in probably what is the most successful and the shittiest way possible. The person who wins by blackmail, who wins by having thought of things that you wouldn't have ever thought of, who wins because somehow you've been put in an extremely compromising situation and you don't know how they did it. That was this person that I wanted to put into a high fantasy world with gods and magic and have them lose to. That was the other thing, is that I wanted to have them lose to George Smiley.
I think it's interesting that it as you talked about how you wrote City of Stairs, you know, your protagonist doesn't really know what's going on, but neither does anybody else and neither does the reader. Yeah. And where in a typical fantasy novel, you know, we have the trope of we always start really small with a, you know, young person usually or somebody isolated from the rest of the world who learns the world at the same pace that the reader does. You know, it's kind of like that farm boy trope, right? The farm boy knows nothing, but everybody else does, and the reader learns with the farm boy.
One thing that I like is writing from the point of view of a group of characters inside of something like an institution, where there it's like it's a highly organized, hierarchical group. In the troupe, it was the orchestra at the start, as well as the troupe itself. In AE, it was, you know, the town, how, like, you know, there were certain people who were in charge and certain people who didn't know anything. But the thing that I like is how these folks in these sorts of highly structured environments talk, how they gossip, how they're like, you know, I can't believe this guy still thinks he can make this project work. I mean, what a fucking idiot. Those are the things that are quite fascinating. And I tried to do that a little bit with the spy network in City of Stairs, where they talk about, like, here's the things we've done. Here's all the assholes that we had. This is something that I think that is missed in a lot of, like, cop shows and doctor shows and spy shows. And what I think works so well in shows like The Wire and things like that is that this is a job. It's organized. It has its own workflow. There's people that you fuck with, that you don't fuck with. And, you know, it's a job. You're doing it 8 hours a day. Sometimes you just want to go have a coffee. Sometimes it's hugely stressful. Sometimes it tears you apart. And other times you get used to it. And sometimes that's inhuman to be like, you know. So there's a great scene in David Mitchell's nonfiction book, Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which is, you know, a great book. I would suggest anybody read that who wants to learn about law enforcement. It's the book that inspired The Wire, where there's this one cop who's on the scene of a murder. This guy's been shot in the head. And he's like, oh, you know, I can tell you what's wrong with this right away. This guy's got a slow leak. He's got a slow leak right here in his head. And it's bleeding out. But if you get a plumber in here, like in the next 5-10 minutes, they can patch this up. They'll have it taken care of in no time. And he's making all these jokes with these guys with this corpse on the floor. And you get the sense that, you know, like, this guy does this shit all the time. He's always making jokes about the corpses. And you start to realize that, you know, yeah, this is a job. These guys, and that if they were actually like, you know, like, if I don't take down this killer, I'll never forgive myself. I mean, like, they probably have like 18 dead bodies on their desk at any point in time that would be solved. If they treated every single one like that, they would die. I mean, like, they would just fall apart. And so I always liked that aspect of, you know, okay, my job is crazy as hell. It's still a job. And if I have a minute to bitch about this one asshole who thinks he's really hot shit, I'm going to do it because I'm a human being.
Yeah, I mean, as you talk about the genre classification stuff, I mean, I guess really what it comes down to in a lot of cases is comparative literature, right? As you compare things to one another and you contrast them to one another, and you're trying to say, how is this like this or how is this different than this? And in the business of literature, that's one of the best ways we have to analyze a work is to compare it to something else like it or something else not like it. And it ends up being very lazy in the genre criticism circles, but we often use the genre that it was written toward or the tropes that it's using to compare it. And I don't know how useful that is to the genre as a whole, but it is extremely useful from a critical perspective of trying to make an argument about a work.
Well, it's worth saying that there are two types of questions. I mean, there's more than two, but for the purposes of this next statement, there's only two types of questions you can ask about a book, which is what type of book is this versus what is this book trying to do? Because you could slap the label of, like, so this book is an urban fantasy. That doesn't say anything about what it's trying to do. It will suggest to some readers what it's trying to do. But that could mean a lot of things. That could be the style. It could be the setting. It could be the plot, like the structure of the plot. For certain people, that locks in all those things. For other people, it doesn't. It means that this takes place in a city. But I would say that we need to be cautious about trying to sort things like this, because fundamentally, what a book is trying to do is what's important. Because when you say, like, what this book is, you know, like, this is an urban fantasy, it needs to be a mystery, it needed to have snark, and it didn't have this shit, so it's bad, is not a valid way of looking at this book, because maybe it didn't want to have snark. Maybe it wasn't about this. Maybe this was actually a book about, like, post 9/11 shit, and you missed it because you liked the Dresden Files and you wanted it to be like that. So, I mean, you need to stop and think about this stuff that we need to look at rather than what these books are like and these sorts of large labels for them. What are they trying to do and what are they trying to say? Because that's when books and all stories really start to matter. One thing that I think is kind of interesting is that a lot of people are comparing City of Stairs, and this is one book that I said that did not inspire my book, to China Mieville. And that's interesting. But I kind of don't see it, because I would say that what his books are interested in doing and what City of Stairs is interested in doing are two really different separate things. They have superficial similarities. They are secondary world cities that have a lot of problems that aren't, you know, beards and swords and kings. They're industrialized. They have their own systems of magic, that kind of crap. To a certain extent, these things look similar. Also, pulls a lot of like inspiration from Eastern Europe and Eurasia, things like that. And so that also makes a lot of people say, well, he did that in City of Stairs, so these things are very similar. But that would be a little bit like saying, you know, like in a hospital, if someone brings in a body and they say, you know, they've got really low platelet counts. This is swelling. This is not swelling. There's no water here, but there is water here. And then being like, you know, well, I'm not going to run any tests to find out what's actually living inside this person causing problems. I'm not going to look at the body. I'm not going to look at the person in the bed. I'm just going to immediately be like, all right, take these pills, because that's what this is. I mean, it's got all this shit that is very similar to this shit, so it must be the same thing. But that would be a very lazy way of being a doctor, and I think it's a lazy way of being a reviewer. I just don't think that my books, and I've only read two of his books. I've only read Perdido Street Station and The City in the City. There's a clinical level of detachment in those books that I find is more similar to, I guess, magical realism. It doesn't even fit in with most fantasy story. You know, I would say that in my books, they're very character oriented. I cut down a huge amount of just these two people in a room, like, talking and bitching, because that's my favorite stuff to write, is two people complaining about each other. And I don't recall scenes like that in his books. So to me, at least, and of course, in my opinion, the writer's like opinion is completely like irrelevant. To me, at least, they don't have the same goals and thus are not similar books at heart.
As we get into this, the world of star ratings and buyer guides and Amazon reviews, you're seeing more and more of that.
It's like fantasy football, you know. Who's going to draft City of Stairs? What do I want to know? And in which round?
Well, it's a high risk, high reward pick for sure.
One thing that I've actually found that makes me a little bit uncomfortable is, you know, there is a group. I mean, like, so far in high fantasy and epic fantasy, most of it is inspired by a handful of centuries in this one region of the world, Western Europe. And this idea of not having something take place in an era inspired by that is for some people really upsetting. They're like, you know, I don't get it. This isn't a fantasy. Where are my kings? Where's, you know, where's the courtly, you know, like, where's the jester? Where's all the shit? And then for other people, they're like, you did a really brave thing by doing this. I mean, like, you went out and you did this thing. And, you know, one of the things about City of Stairs is that its cast is mostly not conventionally white. There's only one real white dude in the whole book. The main character is Southeast Asian, basically. And most of the group, you know, pretty much is not, you know, not English, not Scandinavian, not Caucasian, nothing like that. And there have been a couple of people who are like, you know, like, you did a really good thing by doing this. And this makes me feel like writing fantasy and genre fiction is like being a dad, because the standards have been set so low by preceding generations that I could do the bare minimum and people will like congratulate me for it. And I don't like that. That makes me feel really awkward. Like, for example, like, this was like 2 years ago at a restaurant, my son prolifically shit his pants. And like, it was like, daddy needs to take care of the situation. So I like I ran back and, you know, it was like a 5-10 minute ordeal. But I took care of it, and then I brought him back to the table. And on the way back to the table, this, like, one old lady stopped me and said, "You are such a good dad. Most dads would never do that." And I was like, you know, my son is covered in his own feces. There was a not insignificant chance that he would get his own shit in his mouth. It feels like this should be the bare minimum of, like, quality to make sure that this does not happen. And it kind of, like, it kind of made me wonder, like, in, like, the 50s and 60s, if a dad was, like, with his kid and his kid shit his pants, like, what would he do? Would he just, like, call the cops and be like, "Hello, this is 911. My son pooped himself and I'm a dad." And they'd be like, "Well, we'd be right there, sir, to take care of this issue for you." I mean, as though dads, like, pre 75 or so were just helpless. And so that's kind of what it feels like when someone, you know, says, like, "Are you right? You wrote about someone who was not like you in almost every aspect. Damn. That's a really brave thing to have done." And I'm aware, you know, like, you know, I got mirrors. I'm a white dude. I can do a lot of things. I can probably shoplift at will and might do so. So for me to have done this is by no means, I feel like, anything remarkable. And it makes me feel actually kind of uncomfortable to hear people say this kind of stuff, because there are, like, actual, like, writers of color out there who are having huge issues trying to find their audience. And here's me, who just did this, like, one book, which, you know, has some brown people in it. And getting clapped on the back about this is one of the most, like, surreal experiences. It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens enough for me to be like, "I don't know about this. This is weird."
It gets to something that you said in your post. And you said, we're talking a lot about diversity and having non-white and different perspectives in our fiction, which is tremendous. And you're talking about your experience with that here. And obviously a lot of other writers are doing it too. One of the things you say is it may not mean anything in the long term if the genre itself remains aesthetically stale. And as you've talked about form and structure and how, David Mitchell has really pushed the boundaries of structure and form within the genre, or pushed the structure and form of the genre from outside the genre, I guess you might say. But we're not necessarily seeing that as often. And a lot of times we're seeing, I've heard this said 1,000 times, that in our genres, you can change one thing. And if you change that one thing, everything else needs to stay the same. So if you're going to change, if you're going to have a diverse cast and you're going to go to a non-Western cast of characters and setting and milieu and all that, you sure as hell better give us a story structure that we're familiar with.
That fucking sucks. And it kind of makes a little bit of sense. But I mean, like, that's very frustrating to me, because the more that I read, and I tend to not read in the genre, because, you know, it's like working at a Thai food place and, like, you know, heading home and your wife's like, what do you want? You want some Thai food? And you're like, what the hell's wrong with you? Why would I ever want that? Because, you know, I live and I think about this stuff all the time. Writing is one of the most tremendously flexible forms of art that we have, because, like, film is a dead medium in that it'll be the same thing every single time. Same thing with a TV. It's a dead medium, but it's stretched out like over a longer like amount of time so that it feels a little bit more alive and that you change with the story. But writing really is the chance to completely like immerse yourself in an alien mindset. And if you think of the brain, and I think I talk about this in City of Stairs, as having a lot of different types of input, as in like having, you know, little satellites that can have all these feeds and frequencies that could flow into it. There are certain types of stories that basically only use one or two of these things, when you could be using literally thousands of them. There's all these like kind of like a nuance and to how stories work, how they get inside of you. And I think that to not use these things is kind of like saying, like, you know, like, all right, legs are only for kicking. Don't use legs for walking. Only use legs for just kicking from now on. You'd be like, that's the stupidest thing in the world. There's so many things that you can, there's so many things I can do with my legs. Why would I ever want to just do this one thing? So it is, you know, like, it never even occurs to me to try and do really only one thing, or even to be predictable. And it's kind of weird, because in City of Stairs, you know, I kind of was like, let's have fun in a fantasy genre. And I tried to kind of keep to some of the fantasy genre conventions. And so when this gets in the hands of like fantasy readers, and I'm hearing like, well, I've never read anything like this before, I kind of feel like, you know, like, wow, I fucked up. You know, I kind of wanted to have fun within these parameters and play in this pool, but I'm getting told now that my book's not quite, it doesn't fit quite easily into this thing. And I'm like, whoops, what did I mean, like, I didn't want to be the crazy weird thing that you didn't have a word for. I wanted it to be a fun fantasy story. So I guess that because that's how I think about writing, because I think of writing and reading as not so much this feed, which is where it's, you know, a stream of one type of data into your brain about what's happening on the page, but is instead sort of a symphony in which you're being hit from all different angles in a variety of ways. Wow, that makes me sound very important and special. I mean, like, that's what I write toward to be. Sometimes I'm successful and sometimes I'm not. Because that's how I think of writing. Increasingly, I wonder if I even can do that, if I can stick to one structure, or if I've got to be subversive and always do something weird and strange that people will not expect and maybe not like.
with that, Robert, thanks for being here.
And if y'all want to keep an eye on robertjacksonbennett.com, we'll be converting that site into something very interesting about the city, that about the actual city of Stair. So keep an eye on that and check it out.
This has been Rocket Talk.